Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the History Hit World Wars podcast. If it is your first time here, we are dedicated to that turbulent period in history between 1914 and 1945. And on previous episodes of the World Wars, we have heard from veterans of Bomber Command, people like John Henry Mellor, who was a flight navigator in Lancasters. He flew above those occupied European cities in those flak-filled, dangerous firefights. So we've heard what it was like in these planes. But in this episode, we're going to focus into one of the most famous Lancaster bomber missions, the Dambusters Raid, Operation Chastise, in May 1943. It was here that 19 Lancasters, under the command of Guy Gibson, flew at low level over occupied Europe to strike the dams in the German industrialised Ruhr Valley. Now, 8 of these aircraft would be shot down, 53 of the men on board, drawn from all over the Commonwealth, would be killed, and 3 taken prisoner. But of course, they achieved their ultimate mission goal. They breached one of the dams, and they damaged 2 of them, and they flooded that whole industrial region. To find out more, Dan was joined by the historian Paul Beaver. He was also joined by the Secretary of State for Defence and Wing Commander John Butcher, who's the current Wing Commander of today's 617 Squadron. And they came together to mark the 75th anniversary of the Dambusters Raid. This is a fascinating episode, so enjoy. And if you like the episode, then subscribe to The World Wars on wherever you get your podcasts and follow along online on Twitter at HistoryHitWW2 and on Instagram at James Rogers History. But here's the fascinating history of the Dambusters.
Paul Beaver, welcome back to the podcast. You're such a pro now. You've been on so many times, you could host it, for goodness sakes. Talk to me about what was going on 75 years ago in the early hours this morning.
It really was quite a remarkable time 75 years ago, because it was a full moon, so the Germans were not expecting any activity. And we had a squadron of Lancasters going at ultra low level. I mean, lower than anybody would normally reasonably want to fly. I mean, health and safety hadn't been invented, but they were at 100 feet going across Germany. Sadly, 3 of them didn't make it that far. Eventually, 8 aircraft were shot down, but the aircraft that did actually get there achieved the most remarkable single operation the RAF has ever flown, and that is attacking the dams with bouncing bombs. They're not bombs, of course, they're really aerial mines, but that's getting a bit technical. So the key to it was actually achieving a huge amount of surprise and actually doing the job as planned by that great engineer, Dr. Barnes Wallace, just an amazing guy.
Why bother with the dams on the Ruhr?
Really interesting, isn't it? What is destroying a couple of dams actually going to do? And the answer is quite a lot. And you have to look at it from every angle. So if you look at it from the geostrategic point of view, the big picture, the Russians sat up and said, wow, they can do this at range with a big weapon. The Americans went, we couldn't do that. Churchill was in Washington, was able to brag about it big time, really important for cohesion in the war effort. Then you look at it at the sort of the next level down. What did it do to Germany? It really surprised them and really upset them, because this was a blow to national pride. You know, and no German air, no enemy aircraft will fly over Germany type thing. And there they are. They take these targets out, and they take them out. Okay, 40% losses, that's really high. But actually, the effect was so good. So let's look at that effect in terms of operational. In operational terms, what did it do? Well, it destroyed every bridge for 45 miles, most houses and buildings for about 20 miles. Yes, there's a human cost. About 1,300 people died. In war, there's always human cost. But it also stopped production at about 14 coal mines. It stopped about 250,000 tons of coking coal being produced for the Ruhr industries. And that was the whole point. So back in 1937, it was an option to attack these dams, but there wasn't a weapon. And it was Barnes Wallace who came up with the weapon. This is why he's so crucial to our story. And they did all of that, and they managed to destroy it. And then, of course, they had to do something about it after it had been attacked, because you couldn't just leave a gaping hole in some dams. You needed that water for the Ruhr's industry.
You mentioned Barnes Wallace there. Let's go back and talk about him. What's so remarkable about this operation is how quickly it all came together. I mean, give me a sense of the timeline from the decision to go for it to the development of this bomb and the changing, you know, adjusting the aircraft and training the crews.
It really was quite a remarkable operation. I mean, back in the late winter of 1942. We needed to do something. It was a really bad time. Britain was reeling from the loss of Singapore, of loss of Tobruk, being pushed back in the desert by the Japanese. Everywhere there seemed to be problems. And so to a certain extent, there needed to be a spectacular. But also there needed to be something that would actually shorten the war, because Britain was bleeding and it couldn't sustain it. So what you have, independently of anybody, is Barnes Wallace sitting at home, and it was mainly at home, and he's thinking, I could do something here. I could shift those dams. I can use the force of water. If I do the maths correctly, I can make the dams break up, and I can make the water flow, and I can make it do all this damage. Bombs don't have to do the damage. Nature will do the damage. And he put this idea together, and it got pushed back and pushed back, until eventually it went as high as the Chief of the Air Staff and the Prime Minister, Sir Winston Churchill, then Winston Churchill, who said, it's going to happen. So Bomber Harris, who was the arch enemy of the whole thing, because he called it panacea mongers, you know, what's better than dehousing or destroying every house in Germany? That was his aim, flatten Germany. Barnes Wallace is a bit more humane than that. It came together quite quickly, but then you have to maintain the security. And you have to find the crews. Now, everyone goes on, oh, these are the best crews in Bomber Command. Yes, some of them were, but some of them were brand new, straight out of Operational Conversion Unit. What was so good was this other character who's central to our story, and that's Guy Gibson, a 24-year-old who moulded these people together and created a team really quite unlike any other squadron. Squadron X, it was called originally, didn't even have a number. They didn't even know what bomb they were going to use, a big one, a small one, a round one, a barrel-shaped one. It took all of that work and all of the enthusiasm of Barnes Wallace. He was not going to let anyone say no.
And so how soon after Guy Gibson formed this Squadron X did they find themselves flying through the low level across occupied Europe?
Well, days in effect. I mean, they didn't have the aircraft at the beginning. They had to be borrowing aircraft from other squadrons. That caused a lot of ripples in number five group, because they were on ops every night. They were suffering 7, 8, sometimes 12% losses. So they were hurting. And people were coming and nicking their best aeroplanes to go low-level flying and coming back with damage from flying so low. Eventually, they got their aircraft, thanks to Vickers and thanks to Farnborough, the Royal Aircraft Establishment, and they were able to start practicing with the real aircraft. But, you know, 60 feet, 220 miles an hour, is no mean feat in the dark.
And we should say, what's the wingspan of the Lancaster?
103 feet. So you imagine, you don't have a lot of error there as the pilot. So, you know, and in daylight, it's bloody risky. At night, it's almost suicidal. And you do that on the run to the dams, but getting to the dams, you have to be at 100 feet. Well, 100 feet, you're going to have that choice. Do I go over or under the pylon lines? What do I do? You know, and I'm going around. They were navigating at low level. Everybody in the crew had played a part. That's why they needed the seven-man crew, the bomb aimer, the navigator, the engineer. The wireless operator was doing his job as well, listening out for weather, for example. And the gunners, of course, looking out for the enemy. Everybody was doing their job. So to look at it in that regard, you just have to look at this as mainly a citizen air force. I mean, Guy Gibson was a regular, but a lot of those people had been called up. What an amazing feat of training. You know, it just, to me, it still sends a shiver down my back to think about that. I've flown low level. And I know what it's like. I've flown it at night as well. But I was in a helicopter. So much easier.
And, of course, they were drawn from all over the Allied nations.
Well, drawn all over the Commonwealth. I mean, Canadians, New Zealanders, Australians. I mean, you had some great characters there. And of course, you know, we always remember McCarthy, Big Joe McCarthy, who'd been a New Jersey beach lifeguard and wanted to do something and joined the Canadian Air Force and lied about being a Canadian. And eventually actually became a Canadian and commanded a Canadian Air Force base. But you know, amazing characters. Do you know, so many of them were characters. Some of them were from public schools with Oxbridge, with, you know, rowing blues. They were an amazing bunch of people. Others were just Australian and New Zealand sheep boys. And, you know, and you put them all together. And again, I go back to Guy Gibson. You imagine putting that together. Lesson in leadership. How do you do it? It's carrot and stick. Quite a lot of stick, but also some big carrots. And he sacked some crews. But actually, you know, at the end of the day, it all worked, didn't it?
Talking of big carrots, talk to me about the attack on the dam led by Guy Gibson himself. Just give me a little, just tell everyone at home, just a little sense of just how extraordinary that final bombing run was.
What I think is remarkable, and the reason that Guy Gibson was awarded a Victoria Cross, the highest British gallantry award, is the way in which he led that. So he formed his aircraft up. He had six aircraft up over the dam. And there was more flak, I think, than they expected, more anti-aircraft fire than they expected. He did his first run in and realized that though he dropped the bomb and it was successful, it hit the dam, it wasn't enough, it was going to take more. He realised very quickly that what you really needed to do was to draw the flak off and allow the bombing aircraft at 60 feet, at 220 miles an hour, to actually concentrate on dropping the weapon properly, because the two bombs after him actually didn't work properly. Both skipped over. One destroyed Hopgood's aircraft. The other went over and detonated. But the key to this was that Guy Gibson then put himself in jeopardy several times, flew again and again with the aircraft bombing to draw their fire, with his lights on, all his lights on, every light he could put on, navigation lights, landing lights, everything, so that the German gunners would go for him rather than going for the bombing aircraft. Now that to me is real courage. And then, of course, they had to go for the Ada Dam, which is even worse. It's a really difficult dam. I've flown both of the dams, and I know you have as well. They're really narrow, and getting a big bomber, you know, we go back to this, how big the bomber was, and getting it down onto water where your altimeter isn't going to work, having to use these spotlights, having your flight engineer calling off for you and your navigator calling off the heights. Really, really, really great stuff. And that's why this is epic. That's why we are celebrating 75 years of extraordinary gallantry, leadership, and doing a job that really was necessary.
And I suppose we're commemorating it because of the way it was targeted. We wouldn't be here celebrating the firebombing of Dresden, for example, which was required bravery and skill by the pilots. And the air crew, because in retrospect, we're slightly ashamed, I think, of that policy of just destroying cities entirely. The point about this operation was, although people tragically were killed on the ground, the Royal Air Force was trying to minimise those casualties and trying to strike high-value targets very, very precisely.
Yes, it was all about striking what today we would call a precision effect at range. So it was at the ultimate range of the Lancaster with a very big weapon, more than 6 tons of explosive in the weapon. And to hit that very small target, I mean, we're talking of what, 200 feet of dam expanse. I have to say, big dam. The Moda Dam is bigger than the Hoover or any of the American dams. It's a big dam. Still difficult to get at because the lake is curved, the Menazee. You have to fly around the lake into a corner. To me, it's sad we didn't do more, although 617, of course, went on to hit key targets, launch rocket launch sites, the Biederfeld Viaduct, the U-boat pens, and it was joined eventually by number 9 Squadron, doing the same job also with modified Lancasters to carry the big tall boy Grand Slam bombs, which incidentally came from Barnes Wallace's drawing board again. I mean, this is the thing that I think we could have done more. The problem was that the perceived wisdom was flatten Germany. And I, like you, I like to re-examine history, not to tear it down, but to just take and draw lessons from it. Could we have drawn lessons from that? I think we could. Today, the Royal Air Force are the masters of long-range precision attack. Look at Operation Elemi against Libya, going from Royal Air Force Marham all the way down, delivering effect at the southern part of Libya, right in the Sahara Desert, and flying back again. Now, that's the sort of thing that the Dambusters started. A pity we didn't follow it up.
Paul, thank you very much. Your book on the RAF is coming out.
It is indeed. It's coming out for the 10th of July for the big celebrations in London, 100 aircraft flying down the Mall, which is going to be an amazing day. I'm lucky enough to be invited to Westminster Abbey to celebrate it and to commemorate it. 100 years of the Royal Air Force, the world's first major independent air force.
And you don't know this yet, but you're coming on a podcast to talk about that and your book as well. So look forward to having you on there.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Right. Having heard from Paul Beaver, let's take you to RAF Coningsby, where I was lucky enough to meet the British Secretary of State for Defence, Gavin Williamson. Secretary of State, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. This must be exciting.
This is incredibly exciting. I have never been to see the Lancaster bomber in the flesh, to see it actually here, just the whole history of it, just to think of what it did, what an important role it played. And it's a very humbling experience because it makes you realise the sacrifice that so many people made just to keep this country safe.
So let's walk and have a little look at it. You have got the best stuff of all of your government colleagues, haven't you?
I have the best job, actually, Dan. I mean, it is without a doubt. It's not just the stuff, but it's actually I have the best people in government because you have amazing people who are quite literally willing to give everything in order to the defence and the safety of Britain. And you're always struck by just what they can do, the can-do attitude. But then you realise that you're there to look after that and preserve it for the future and that capability for the future as well.
When you're sitting at your desk down there in London, do you think about the history? Do you think about the past? Because, you know, again, like no other government department, you've got such a remarkable heritage.
Well, I think it's actually, you shouldn't be so bound in by the past, but because everything, if you think of the RAF, 100 years of the RAF, how much it's evolved in those 100 years. But the past sort of gives the grain to the services. It gives the sense of where they've come from and the sense of belonging that's created in the services. So I think it's a really important thing to preserve. But actually, when you speak to whether it's pilots or air crew in the Royal Air Force, whether it's those people serving the Royal Navy or the Army, actually what they're equally so excited about is the future. And, you know, you think about the F-35, the new Lightning aircraft that are going to be coming. Actually, you speak to every pilot wants to get in one, they want to fly one, they want to see what their capabilities are. But then they have an immense reverence for what's gone before them and the amazing feats that people have done in those past generations. And that's a wonderful combination because you want to be excited about the future as against just looking at the past because you want to be making your new histories.
It must be very hard for you looking ahead at the future, the challenges that Britain faces, what kit to invest in. I mean, It must. I mean, how do you stay? How do you sleep at night?
Well, I'm always really lucky that I've got amazing people to advise me. So if John tells me to go and get something for the F-35, I'll just do what John says. You see, so you have amazing people, and at the end of the day, you know, I'm not there to try and be. I'm not there to be a general, an admiral, an air marshal. I'm there to be the politician that is their voice around the cabinet table and tries to get what we need in order for them to do the amazing job that they're doing. So John will be delighted to hear that I don't do actually the organisation of the strikes that he'll be asked to do, but I'm there to be responsible for it.
So we're standing underneath one of the greatest British bits of engineering of all time.
Do you think we should take it out to fly? I think this is what we... I mean, I have no experience. I don't know about you.
We got John here. We'll be all right. Yeah. we're standing... It is obviously extraordinary in terms of its development, in terms of the way it was deployed. What are the lessons that you, as a politician, can draw from 75 years ago?
When we sort of think about that, whether it's the Dambusters raid, whether it's everything that we did in the Second World War, it's actually innovation that is the key, and it's the constant use of technology. Obviously, in times of war, the innovation moves so much faster, but actually, as an armed forces, we've got to get better at taking technology and how it's evolving quicker to make sure that it's given to John and everyone else who is serving in the armed forces, to make sure that they have the advantage and they have the competitive advantage over our adversaries. And it's how you can use that more, how you can bring it into service a lot quicker, because one of the things I think that we've always had a weakness in the armed forces is sometimes programs and sort of delivery of new aircraft just take too long, and we probably just have to start looking at things in a different way, how we can bring technology faster and actually how we move on with technology much quicker.
Well, this aircraft was developed for the Dambusters raid and the upkeep bomb in a space of a few months. So, I mean...
This is the challenge. I'm going to go to BAE Systems and say, you know, how they can sort of meet that. But actually, defence, it isn't just about those people who are serving in the services. I mean, there's 250,000 jobs that are tied up in the defence industries, either supporting... UK armed forces or in terms of exports. So it does affect an awful lot of people's lives. And again, it's that technology, it's that innovation. This was the absolute cutting edge of technology 75 years ago. In another 75 years, they'll look at the F-35 and they'll look at the Typhoon and think, you know, lovely, amazing, but sort of almost quite quaint, and how that technology has moved on from there. And it's just looking at how you can seize that moment as quickly as possible.
This last question, because you've got lots of people want to talk to you. Do you feel you're in the room now where history is being made? Does that feel momentous? Do you worry about how the future will judge the decisions you're making?
Absolutely. So when I think about when we had the recent strike in terms of Syria following the chemical weapons, you just really worry, because you know, you're asking people to do something which means that they might not return. And if you don't worry about that, and if you don't get concerned, and if it doesn't play on your mind, I don't think you're taking your job seriously. What's really interesting, and I had some of the guys come, had a chat with them, so focused on the operation and the pride that they take in it and the professionalism that they do it makes you realise that you are looking after something incredibly precious, but you equally know that they do everything they can do to minimise the risk. And they're just the best people, best air force in the world. And our job is to give them the best equipment to do the very best job.
Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
So nice to meet you.
That was meant to be the end of our interview, but as you'll hear, Gavin Williamson had different ideas, and what followed was rather unexpected. Certainly caught the RAF organisers by surprise.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Are we loud in it?
Well, let's ask the station commander. Here we go.
Are we loud to go in it?
Shall we? You're the boss.
Come on. Have you been in? There is no point in being Secretary of State for Defence if you don't...
Well, that's right. Now, you'll discover, luckily, you're a very fit Secretary of Defence, because they are famously difficult aircraft to get round.
Can I just be careful on your head there.
Yes.
OK, you can touch the yellow handrails on the left, yes. And you're on a walkway. Don't step off the walkway, or you'll probably go to the bottom of the aeroplane.
Okay. Walkway and...
Watch your head.
Are you coming in?
I'll follow you in, yeah.
I'll follow you in as well.
Brilliant.
And then the wing strut is an absolute nightmare on these.
Really?
Here we go.
So you can imagine if you were in here as a young man, a 20-year-old from New Zealand or maybe a 19-year-old from Wales, in all of your kit at night, exceptionally cold, minus 40 degrees in this aircraft, you're covered in ammunition and fuel, so an intensely dangerous machine to be in. If you want to sit on that spar, Minister, and then swing your legs over, or if you can put your legs in first, it's quite awkward. And watch your head as you keep going up there.
He's straight over, listeners. He's just straight over. The man has been doing his Pilates.
Well, I wouldn't go. Isn't this just such an amazing...
But if you imagine, you know, 7-man crew in here, often they would do 1,000 bomber raids, exceptionally cold, and an exceptionally dangerous place to be, in here for 7 or 8 hours while people try and kill you, and doing it night after night, really, really brave men.
I mean, doesn't it just make you... You just sort of think of a history and actually, as you say, the bravery of people and actually, you know, just the fear that they must have actually sometimes felt.
Well,
doing...
absolutely. I mean, they would have seen aeroplanes exploding. They'd be flying along huge formations, no air traffic control, night fighters trying to kill them, you know, exceptionally dangerous. Young man here, not only the captain, but also a leader. So he could be from New South Wales, he could be from Scotland.
And how old might he probably have been?
18, 19, 20.
And
kids.
Such a responsibility. We take so much for granted, don't we?
Do.
You just don't realise the sacrifice that sort of people sort of took and actually the sort of kind of such young age and there they were.
And they're all like this. They're all like this. And then for them it was just a job. They're so humble. And what they did was absolutely remarkable, but night after night as well. And you look at the size of this aeroplane. The Dambusters flew this at 60 feet. Now, I've flown Jaguars at 250 feet at night with night vision goggles, with a moving map, and that is dangerous.
Yeah.
Flying a bomber aeroplane at those heights, astonishing feat of flying.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing what they did.
Because it was the rear gunners who were the most vulnerable, wasn't
Absolutely.
It? And they were the ones who usually got taken with really high attrition rates.
Yeah, exactly. A, because it's freezing cold back there. So my grandfather flew these aeroplanes. His first rear gunner had to leave the Air Force for frostbite in his fingers.
Oh.
We're being dragged out. Oh, what a pity. Okay. What a pity.
Don't blame me.
Yeah.
But you're actually right, the rear gunner, he was a lookout man. If you fired, actually you risked highlighting your position so often, crews wouldn't fire because the tracer would show where they were.
Yeah.
And you wanted to keep yourself as hidden away.
Stealth
hope go after another guy.
Like,
yeah, but often they would be the first guy to see the night fighter. And then they'd call a corkscrew where the pilot would put the aeroplane into a diving left or right-hand turn. So you imagine this aeroplane, you know, all of a sudden you're at 3 or 4G pinned to the side of the aircraft. It would have been terrifying.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, they're not sort of small, delicate
no,
things.
No.
But were they reasonably agile?
For a big aeroplane, absolutely, yeah. I mean, they would really chuck them around. And it's a large aircraft, but it handles in many ways like a fighter. It's an absolutely superb machine. And it would come home, you'd pull the wings off it, and it would bring you home time after time. That's why it was such a popular aeroplane with the crews, because they had utter faith in this aircraft.
It was just reliable and solid, yeah, and just did the job.
Yeah, they loved it to bits, and they still do. When they come back, they absolutely love it to bits.
There's something so beautiful when you actually sort of see them in the air, and it's just like, brings out the emotion. It just, well, as I say, just a living piece of history. And I imagine they sort of almost felt like living organisms.
Absolutely. I mean, she's called She, you know, she's treated as a girl. The boys love her. There's a real affection for it. But, you know, it's the best of British, this machine, because we've got Rolls-Royce Merlin engines. Of course, Rolls-Royce are, you know, arguably the best manufacturer of engines in the world. And it's, you know, entirely designed by the British, made in Britain. And it really is, you know, it highlights what a great country we are.
I'm not sure if you've ever been to Crewe, you know, the Bentley Works, where they used to make the engines, and you've just got this most beautiful Merlin engine sat at the entrance. And they say that this is just to remind you where actually the sort of roots of a factory were and the important role it played in the Second World War.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you just see that engine, and you just, the engineering, the quality, it just, everything just inspires
Absolutely.
You. And you just want to take kids to go and see the engine and sort of see, you know, what an inspiration it can be. You just need to do more of it,
absolutely.
Don't we?
Absolutely.
Now I'm just walking back down through the aircraft where we're in trouble because the Secretary of State is now behind schedule because of his enthusiasm for this aircraft.
The stress and the pressure there must have been under.
Look at this, it's all ammunition. Obviously it's not live now, but this would, I mean, if you tap the wall of the aeroplane, that wouldn't stop a shotgun round. So once this is on fire, you know, you are in serious trouble. Yeah. Watch your head as you come back.
I certainly will do. Well, I have to say, Dan, I really do like all the programmes you do. But one thing I always think you, and this sounds incredibly boring and dull, you can always tell politicians when they have what they think is a good programme idea.
Yeah.
But I always think you should do a programme on, you know, like the history of the...
Next up, I heard from John Butcher, a.k.a. Butch. He's the current commander of 617 Squadron. Wing Commander John Butcher. Butch. I understand you.
Hello, Dan.
No, Nat. We're standing under the Lancaster now. The Secretary of State has finally left. He's like a kid in a candy store. But you actually know he's over there looking at Spitfires now. But tell me about the job this aircraft did. And how similar is it to the job that you're going to be doing in your F-35 when it goes into service?
So the Lancaster's main role was bombing during the Second World War, and that's what it was designed to do. And it did very well. And it progressed through the war and changed technology. And by the time that the 617 Squadron did its Danbusters raid in 1943, it was at the very cutting edge of technology using those capabilities. Compare it to today. I'm standing here next to it and looking at when I walk to an F-35, and it's a crew of one compared to a crew of seven with a much smaller bomb bay, or weapons bay, as we would call it in the F-35. And we're now able to be far more precise than they were able to be. It's such a step change.
Because that's the key difference, isn't it? That this had to have a big bomb load because it couldn't be sure it was actually going to hit the things it wanted to hit.
That's right. The targeting was quite difficult, and they were using free-fall weapons to try and hit those targets. Whereas today we can be very precise using GPS or laser-guided weapons, and that really is a giant leap.
So in the Second World War, it's thought 8 or 9% of the bombs hit their target, and even by hitting target, I think that meant sort of land somewhere quite near their target. Today, are you amazed if a weapon, is something going wrong if it's not 100%?
Yeah, we always aim to be as precise as we possibly can, and that is our expectation with all of our weaponeering, that we hit the target.
Now, your grandfather flew one of these. Tell me about his service.
Yeah, so a very inspiring story for me personally, that he was a pilot on 12 and 626 Squadron, based up at RAF Wickenby. And he flew operationally in 1943 and 1944, did his 30 missions with his crew, amazingly managed to survive through that, and then went on to be an instructor on the Lancaster training unit.
I'm not surprised. Sounds like he had what it took.
Yeah, I mean, he and I spent many hours when I was much younger talking about his service history. And it really inspired me to get involved. I loved the stories of what it felt like to be in the Royal Air Force, to be with that crew. And obviously I was too young really to comprehend the danger and the threat that they were in at the time, something that I've learned over later years. But he personally is a big inspiration for me as to what I do today.
And you were lucky enough to know him into your adult life. And in fact, I think, you know, you were on, he saw you go on deployment with the RAF yourself.
He did, yeah. He died about 10 years ago now. And I was in operations in Afghanistan flying the Harrier. So he saw me progress he was there when I got, the day I got my wings, the day I commissioned into the Royal Air Force. So he was there at those important milestones for me personally. And I know that was important to him, and it was certainly very important to me.
And what, by that stage, you'd moved on from sort of anecdotes and things of your childhood, like I remember with my grandfather. I mean, was he able to sort of talk about, you know, flying, real stuff by that stage? Or was it always difficult for him to talk about those kind of things with you as his grandson?
From my perspective, he was always very open and honest, and he was able to give me the details when I asked the specific questions. And we were also very fortunate that he came to one of my flying stations and actually gave a presentation on what he had done during his service career. And so, yeah, I think he was very comfortable talking about it. I think he understood that it was important to talk about what had happened and, you know, the experiences that he and his crew went through in delivering bombs during the Second World War.
What things that as a child you might not have appreciated, but as a pilot you really listened to your grandpa and went, wow, that's useful advice?
Well, from a flying perspective, he always used to say, you know, keep your head on a swivel. The rest of it was just, you know, sort of fly safe. I think that sort of grandfather looking at his grandson probably thinking, oh crikey, have I given him too much inspiration to go and do a job that's slightly dangerous? But yeah, he was always very supportive, and that's what I remember.
And so he was remarkable in surviving all of those raids. Did he have great affection for this aircraft? I mean, did he think this aircraft was a big part of that reason for his survival and that success?
I think he probably did. There were a lot of pictures up in his house of the Lancaster. I remember him having an audio tape of the Merlin engines, which he just used to occasionally play. I think just to hear the hum of the sound of the engines going. So I think he does put it down to, you know, the technology. He had a couple of hairy nights where his aircraft had taken some pretty serious damage, and she still got him and his crew home. And I think that is where that real affinity sits with him.
And he was how old during the war, approximately?
He was in his very early 20s.
Terrifying. Much younger than us.
Yeah. I mean, amazing how those young men climbed into one of these every night to go and do that in the face of such terror.
It's not just the equipment that's inspiring, I suppose. It must be the people as well, your grandfather, but also Guy Gibson, legendary Victoria Cross winner, legendary, well, the first man to have your job, officer commanding 617 Squadron.
Yeah, it's a huge privilege to be in the position that I'm in. Big boots to fill. And I do think, though, that if I had the opportunity to take Guy Gibson around 617 Squadron today, I think I hope he would recognise the same spirit and determination that he managed to instil in his people 75 years ago. And I certainly draw on that a lot with my people, you know, to remember what it is that they did in a very short space of time with absolute cutting-edge technology at the time as well, and try to bring those synergies to where we are today.
Yeah, so when you look back at Guy Gibson's generation, what are the lessons? What are the attributes that you are trying to channel?
Well, it's being comfortable with operating cutting-edge technology, I think, is a very important part of what 617 Squadron is now about. You know, we really are at the cutting edge with F-35, and that is important for us to remember as a whole team within 617. But then there's the element of, you know, he took a squadron on the 23rd of March 1943 and had them operationally flying by the 16th of May. And I have a lot longer, thankfully. But the skill sets that we need to be able to do with F-35 are much broader. And so I really try and bring that spirit of determination out in people that we need to be ready to do all of these mission sets, and we need to be able to do it from land or from sea. And so readiness through the spirit and determination that I really believe that he had in 1943 with his team, I think is where that really sits.
And now talk to me more about your plans. This summer, very exciting. F-35, which is Britain's latest strike platform, but well, tell me about F-35. I mean, is it the dream? Is it basically a combination of the Lancaster we're standing on now and the Spitfires we're looking at the room, a combination of bomber and fighter interceptor?
It is absolutely a combination of those two, and it's a leap on top of that And why I would say that is F-35, it's stealthy. We are able to evade radar. When you look at the Dambusters raid, they had to fly low to make sure that they weren't detected going in. Well, we can still fly at normal altitudes now when we're undetected. We can drop bombs. We can fire missiles. We have the ability to really listen to what's going on out in the battle space around us with all of the sensors that the F-35 has. And it displays it to us in a way that is very understandable for us to be able to understand what's going on around us and make good decisions in quite tense scenarios.
You're at the moment you're in the US, and so what's the plan this summer?
So we're going to be bringing the jets back, and we should have all of the jets back from Beaufort in South Carolina by the end of the summer to our future home of Royal Air Force Marham.
Brilliant. Not quite in Lincolnshire, but nearby.
Near enough.
Near enough to Bomber County. Thanks very much, Butch. And I hope to see you as the year goes on, and perhaps on the carrier as well, because your aircraft, unlike these Lancasters, will be able to deploy from land, airfields, but also from the Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah, that's right. And that's another added facet to the technology that we've got with F-35. It gives us the ability to do all of those missions that I just talked about and be able to do that from the land or from the sea. And that really gives us a lot of operational options.
How soon before... This is a brutal question to ask you. It's like someone asking me when AI can do TV presentering. How soon before we are looking, do you think, at unmanned strike aircraft? Or will there always be a job people like you in that cockpit?
Well, already we use unmanned air vehicles to do strikes. Obviously, there are still people in the loop operating and making the decisions. I have no idea how close we are to having completely autonomous solutions. I'm sorry.
Let's hope it's long enough for you to enjoy a long and happy career in the RAF. Pull up the ladder behind you.
And before you go, remember, as a Warfare listener, you get a special discount at History Hit. Subscribers get access to blissfully uninterrupted ad-free podcasts and thousands of hours of history documentaries. You've got everything from the American Revolution to my own documentaries like Traces of War, Weapons of War, and 24 Hours in Normandy, where I follow in the footsteps of the Green Howards on D-Day, from their beach landings to being awarded the Victoria Cross, and all the way through their first day where they made it 7 miles inland, further than any other British or American unit. So head over to historyhit.com/subscribe or follow the link in the show notes and use the code WARFARE to get 50% off your next 3 months. That's the code WARFARE to get 50% off. And if you're an Apple listener, you can subscribe for new ad-free episodes within the app. So give it a go. I know you're gonna love it.